This Sandwell News podcast is divided into chapters.
Entering the third week of March, sunrise will be at 6:16 and sunset will be just after 6:15 p.m. Temperatures will be around 7 degrees Celsius and a little breezy.
The Sandwell News, due to be with you on the 14th of March for the blind and visually impaired community living in and around Sandwell. And let's start as we usually do, with some events, activities coming up at SVI in the next week.
Hello SVI friends and volunteers. Here are the activities taking place next week, Tuesday 17th March. Gym at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 10 to 12 noon. Break a sweat and boost your energy with fellow SVI members. From treadmills and bikes to weights, there's something for everyone. And plenty of support to help you along the way. It's a fun, social way to stay fit and active all year round, rain or shine. Line dancing at Dartmouth Central Club, 1 to 2:30 p.m. Put on your dancing shoes and join Ray and Jean for a lively line dancing session full of fun and feel-good moves. Whether you're looking to stay active, improve your balance, or simply meet new people, this is the perfect chance. Absolute beginners are welcome. Just come along and enjoy. We'd love to see you on the dance floor. Wednesday, 18th March. Men's group at West Bromwich Town Hall, 10:30 to 12 noon. We're having an informal session this month at SVI with the men's group. It's a relaxed get-together where we'd love to hear your ideas about where you'd like to go for our next social outing. No pressure, just come along, have a chat, and share any suggestions you have. Hope to see you there. Showdown at Portway Lifestyle Centre, 1 to 3 p.m. Come and join us for this fast-moving, interactive sport that's a mix of table tennis and air hockey. It's specially designed for blind and visually impaired players. But the best part is anyone can play and everyone has fun. Expect laughter, friendly competition, and a chance to try something a little different. Why not come along and see what it's all about? Thursday, 19th March. West End crooners show performing hits from the Rat Pack, Hale Sowen Town Hall. Pick up 1 p.m. show starts 2:30 p.m. Step back in time to the golden age of swing as the coolest guys in town take you on a journey through the unforgettable hits of the Rat Pack. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr. Light refreshment and a licensed bar are available. The cost of the afternoon is £24, including transport from West Bromwich. Pick up at West Bromwich bus station, 1 p.m, return by 5:30 p.m. Advance booking and payment are essential, so call the office to reserve a place. If you don't need transport, contact the office for cost and further details. Tickets are still available. Saturday, 21st March. Touch tour and audio described performance of Matthew Bourne's Red Shoes ballet at the Hippodrome. The double Olivier award-winning smash Hit the Red Shoes returns in Matthew Bourne's spellbinding ballet. This intoxicating production tells the story of young dancer Victoria Page, torn between ambition and love, through powerful choreography, stunning design, and a sweeping golden age Hollywood score. A breathtaking ballet where life imitates art, the Red Shoes will dazzle your senses and break your heart. Touch tour at 1 p.m, performance at 2:30 p.m. Please note that this event is now full. It is important that you contact the office, either by phone, message, Facebook, or email, to let us know that you are attending any of our events. That's all for this week. We look forward to seeing you soon. The SVI team. Sandwell, visually impaired. West Bromwich Town Hall. Lodge Road, West Bromwich. B708AY. Telephone 012 1524810. www.sandwellvisuallyimpaired.org.uk.
Some of the pieces from this week's readings from the Express and Star. Wednesday, 4th of March. Black Country and Birmingham compared. Street racing ban extended for another year. Schools fight craze warning. Thursday. Changes to look out for at big supermarkets. The Langley History Group. The baggies away matches coach. Two teens deliberately knocked off their e-bike. Friday. Councillor quits party after row. Plan to build new flats. Peaky Blinders film review. Saturday. Blue badge prosecutions. New special needs school places. Morris in charge of Albion until end of season. Peaky Blinders event at Wensbury Town Hall. Campaign for red squirrel emojis. Monday. Baggies out to attack home doubleheader. Human performers outdo AI. More cafes and shops going cashless. Weatherman brings sunshine to his audiences. Tuesday, 1.3 million cost to make way for new homes. Ongoing inquiries into e-bike crash. Food waste action week. Decline in ring and ride use. 200 years of Eddie Gray's sweets.
Rather strange, Virtual Russell there, dragging out Eddie Gray's Sweets, the name of the company, that is, who run the shops in Dudley and further afield. Those headlines and more coming up with kind permission of Express and Star newspapers. Later on, we'll have the usual listing for TV and radio programmes for the week ahead. But to start with, we'll go back a week or so to the first day's news from the papers.
This is James Brodie bringing to you stories from the Express and Star, dated the 4th of March. Black Country versus Birmingham, how industry and the language built two proud but very different cultures. University professor and pro vice chancellor says these variations should be jointly celebrated. This story is brought to you by Dr. Steve McCabe. Supporting this article is a black and white industrial image, and the title says workers pile out from the former Sunbeam factory, which was on the corner of Poole Street and Jeddo Street in Wolverhampton. The Canterville Ghost, a humorous short story written by Oscar Wilde and published in February 1887, includes the line, "We have really everything in common with America nowadays, except of course language." I'm reminded of this in considering the supporting differences that exist between Birmingham and the Black Country, most especially in terms of the citizens. Whilst language, which I'll consider shortly, and of course culture, are vitally important when considering what constitutes the essence of people, the geographical and or resources that attract inhabitants to a particular location must also be recognised. Like Birmingham, the dominant city in the West Midlands region, what we accept to be the Black Country is widely accepted to be largely defined by the 30-foot seam of coal which is close to or indeed comes to the surface. As such, this would include West Bromwich, Colesley, Oldbury, Blackheath, Cradley Heath, Old Hill, Bilston, Dudley, Tipton, Wensbury and parts of Hales Owen, Walsall and Smethwick, formerly Worley. Wolverhampton, which gained city status in 2000, is considered to be in the Black Country precisely because of its critical influence on the trade and industry resulting from the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution, the origins of which are due to the invention of the steam engine using coal, which is known as the New Common Engine, was constructed near Dudley in 1712 to pump water from coal mines belonging to Lord Dudley, utterly defines the history of the Black Country. From the latter part of the 1700s, the abundance of coal, as well as iron deposits, became vital elements of the generations of products and wealth that were to ensure employment and growth in the area for the next two centuries. However, the production of coal, made by heating coal in the absence of air, iron, glass, bricks and steel produced high levels of soot and air pollution, which unsurprisingly made everything, including all too frequently the people, look dirty and black and led to the area's name. The first use of the Black Country was in the Staffordshire Advertiser as a consequence of a town clerk in Lichfield who was addressing a reformers meeting in November the 24th, described a visit held made to the Black Country of Staffordshire, Wolverhampton, Bilston and Tipton. It's notable that Gavin Jones, writing in the Black Country Bugle in April 2013, describes a travelogue originally published in 1860, in which the author explains that the expression Black Country, as it's eminently descriptive for blackness everywhere, prevails. The ground is black, the atmosphere is black, and the underground is honeycombed with mining galleries stretching in utter blackness for many a league. Equally notable, Elihu Burritt, the American consul to Birmingham in 1862, describes what he saw in the Black Country as black by day and red by night. This attests to the fact that demand for products made in the Black Country, such as locks for security, nails, chains, all sorts, including those for the Titanic manufactured in Netherton by N. Hingley & Sons Limited in Netherton, fireclay products and enamelware, was so intense that the production continued late into the evening. Early access to clay allowed bricks to be produced, which, given the rate of building required for housing for workers and new factories springing up, was such in demand. To be fair, Birmingham at a similar time would not have looked that much cleaner, as it was also burning prodigious amounts of coal, and in vast numbers of factories would have been producing equally noxious fumes and pollution. I've seen pictures taken in the centre of Birmingham in the early 1960s, looking towards suburbs, clearly showing a grey haze over the inner city in which the majority of factories were located. Factories in both Birmingham and the Black Country created magnets drawing in those in search of regular employment that was viewed as a preferable alternative to the seasonal and subsistence income from working the land. Pointedly, towns in the Black Country and Birmingham developed rapidly, a demand for products being produced increased exponentially. The experiences of the vast majority of citizens occurred separately. Whilst the arrival of trains made travel much easier for most workers in either place 6 days working, and the mandatory requirements to attend church on a Sunday meant that there was little time for inclination to travel. Remember, through the Bank Holidays Act in 1871, created the right for workers to have such days off. Most workers had to do so without pay. The right of workers to be able to have 1 week's holiday with pay only commenced with the passing of the Holiday with Pay Act in 1938. Birmingham phrases. Common Birmingham words or phrases. Boston, amazing or brilliant. Bab, babby, a term of endearment or a baby. Cob, a bread roll. Tar a bit, see you later, stroke goodbye. Island, that's a roundabout. Gamble, a forward roll. Guilty, entry, an alleyway. Wench, an affectionate term for a young woman. Pop or fizzy pop, that's soft drinks or soda. Council pop, tap water. Outdoor, an off licence. Mither, or mither spelt M-Y-T-H-E-R, to pester or bother someone. Having a benny, that's throwing a temper tantrum or a strop. Yampy, silly or acting crazy. Donnies, hands usually used with children. Give us your donnies. Shrapnel, loose change or small change. Round the reekin, taking a long roundabout way to a destination. This ain't getting a babby frock and a pinny. This is getting us nowhere or wasting time. It's raining in, so it's rain is coming in through a window or a door. Key aspect of the dialect, mom, used instead of mum for mother. Ear, here you are. Leg it, run away. Reza, the reservoir often refers to Edgbaston Reservoir. The cut, the canal. Chobble, to chew loudly, or don't chobble your ox. Slumocking, standing or walking in a lazy, slovenly way. Riling, fidgeting or rolling around. Wag, to skip school. Black Country phrases. Common Black Country words or phrases. Boston, excellent or great. Bost, broken. Cob, a bread roll. Fizzog, that's a face. Wommel, a dog. Blartin, crying or sobbing. Fittle, food. Gully, a small alleyway or gap between houses. The cut, the canal or network. Picklet, a crumpet. Yampy, silly or daft. Saft, soft or silly. Got a cob on, I'm in a bad mood. How bit, how you doing? Tar a bit, see you later. I be going, I'm not going. Call be bothered, cannot be bothered. All around the reekin, going the long way round. Key pronunciation and grammatical features. I am often becomes I bay. Baby is pronounced babby. No is often described as nah. My can become me, e.g. taking me flirtier. Hand is pronounced ond. Don't becomes don. As Laura Clark explains in the Birmingham versus Black Country dialects, whilst Birmingham and the Black Country are geographically close, their dialects exhibit distinct characteristics that reflect in their unique histories and cultural identities. Both dialects enrich the linguistic diversity of the West Midlands, offering a fascinating glimpse into the regional cultural tapestry. There are, she continues, pronunciation differences, whereas Brummies tend to make the letter R non-rhetoric and I in often or as oi, whereas those in the Black Country retain the letter R, making it rhetoric. Clark believes Black Country speech is frequently characterised by being broader and more rounded compared to Brummie. Fascinatingly, she states her view that there is a difference between citizens of Birmingham and the Black Country in intonation and rhythm, the former tending to have a downward inflection, making statements sound like questions to non-locals, and the latter speaking in a way that's more musical when compared to the Brummie accent, giving it a unique cadence that stands out even within the West Midlands. Of course, words or expressions used in each area provide a very useful indicator of which part of the West Midlands the person is speaking from. Once again, Clark explains that through the characteristics brought by the tendency to drop consonants, so according to her, Brummies drop the G from words ending, and those from the Black Country have a tendency to drop the H from words beginning with this letter. Though there's still a sense of pride and distinctiveness of the two areas, there's much which equally unites them. Indeed, the creation of the Metropolitan County of the West Midlands on the 1st of April 1974 consisted of Birmingham, Coventry, Dudley, Sandwell, Solihull, Walsall and Wolverhampton would achieve homogeny in strategic approach born of a belief that the consistency in dealing with all parts of the area would be beneficial. As a footnote of the headquarters of the West Midlands County Council, which was the first Lancaster Circus, which had become a storage depot for a major motorcar, spares and cycle retailer, but was converted to offices and served this purpose until the organisation was abolished in 1986, then being used by Birmingham City Council into 2022 when it was sold off. The creation of the county for the West Midlands in the 1970s was not welcomed by all, arguing that attempting to create a no matter how well-meaning consistency and continuity in the way industry and commerce was encouraged and supported could potentially represent a dilution of the very places which created wealth and opportunities in both Birmingham and the Black Country. The fact that the West Midlands County Council lasted only 12 years, abolished as representing another unnecessary bureaucracy, layer of local government under the Thatcher administration, tells its own story, even though it has been partly recreated under another Conservative government as the West Midlands Combined Authority. The 1970s were, as it's now recognised, the halcyon days of the manufacturing sector that had created many amazing products and crucially opportunities for employment and advancement in the region. Through manufacturing, particularly in so-called metal bashing, that had been characteristics of the Black Country, had already started to decline. The election of a neoliberal approach under Margaret Thatcher in May 1979 hastened a rise in the number of factories closing, which as well as inevitably increased unemployment and social deprivation and hollowing out of communities created a bleak and scarred landscape, all too obvious to those travelling through the Black Country, most especially in trains passing through Wolverhampton as I did when going to and from Manchester when I was attending university. Birmingham, while suffering a similar decline, appeared initially at least to be coping better and the scarring arguably less obvious. However, and whilst I acknowledge the danger of enraging in misty-eyed sentimentality about the loss of factories, those could be dangerous and grimy places to work. They at least offered regular, well-paid jobs that have in large part not been replaced, certainly not in the gig economy. The shiny office buildings and the retail parks, whilst I predict not be remembered with the same fondness as factories currently are by those who are often spent a large proportion of their adult life working in them, both my parents worked in factories here in Birmingham and could attend to the social bonds and friendships that were formed whilst working in manufacturing. Sadly, you have to be outrageously optimistic to believe that a manufacturing sector in Birmingham and the Black Country will ever experience a renaissance that would ensure levels of employment that used to exist half a century ago. Worse, it would appear that the newly forms of employment are equally at risk from changing consumer patterns and the rapid development of AI, that's artificial intelligence. So, in a way of conclusion, it may be that the very differences that exist in place and people between Birmingham and the Black Country should jointly be celebrated as representing the basis of future development and opportunity. Culture, I'd suggest, is the new rock and roll visitors are attracted to history and imbued with the experience of those who contributed to ensuring the region was a cradle of industrial revolution and is noted as having created products that were the envy of the world. Those in charge of the West Midlands Combined Authority, who face an immense challenge in ensuring economic and social growth, should consider building more museums, though in the current climate, even keeping the existing ones remains a priority. Culture, I stress, is precious, and it is the Philistines who disregard that maxim. Dr. Steve McCabe is Professor and Pro Vice Chancellor at Birmingham City University, teaching and researching economics, management and business. High Court extends injunction banning street racing to 2027. Order will remain in place across Wolverhampton, Sandwell and Walsall areas. This story is brought to you by James Fikmorovich. An injunction banning street racing across parts of the Black Country is set to continue for another year. The decision by the High Court follows a review hearing in Birmingham on February 26, where Wolverhampton Council, Sandwell Council and Walsall Council applied for the injunction along with the associated powers of arrest to remain in place across all three boroughs until at least March 1, 2027. The injunction prohibits people from taking part in street racing as a driver, rider or passenger, or promoting, organising or publicising gatherings, or from attending as a spectator. The injunction covers the whole of the boroughs of Wolverhampton, Sandwell and Walsall, and anyone found to be breaching it will be in contempt of court and may be imprisoned, fined or have their assets seized. They may also be ordered to pay the council legal costs of any hearing. At Thursday's review hearing, Her Honour Jude Kelly agreed that the injunction should continue with minor amendments to the wording after considering evidence from three claimant councils demonstrating its positive impact. In writing evidence, Pardeep Nagra, Wolverhampton Anti-Social Behaviour Team Leader, said, "The information provided clear illustrates that street racing is still a very, very real issue within the Black Country and that the full injunction order should remain in place to provide reassurance to the public and to save lives." PC Mark Campbell from the Operations Hercules West Midlands Police Tactical Response to Street Racing provides data showing a massive decrease in the number of vehicles taking part in street racing between April and November of 2025. He said, "I cannot overstate the benefit of the current injunction and the importance of renewing this injunction. The Black Country local authorities are seeing a huge drop in organised meets. However, it is only a matter of time before we see the return of the car cruises, and the renewal of the injunction will allow officers from the West Midlands Police to carry on the good work conducted over the last 12 months. In her order, Jude Kelly said that the compelling justification for the injunction and power of arrest remains. The updated evidence establishes that the amended injunction and power of arrest and having a deterrent effect, but that street cruising activities continues to be a problem as evidenced by the successful contempt applications over the past year. The need for divisionary courses, reports from the local residents and police monitoring activity. To the extent that overall street cruising activity has been reduced from what was seen in the prior to injunctive relief being in place. It's well established that the evidence of this kind is not evidence that the risk has abated. At the same hearing, an application to discontinue the injunction in Dudley was also permitted, with Dudley Council saying it intends to use alternative powers at the disposal to tackle street racing locally. This will not impact on the enforceability of the injunction in Sandwell, Walsall or Wolverhampton. Schools in fight craze warning. This story is brought to you by Dan Stacey. Head teachers and the police have warned of the new social media craze in which pupils are encouraged to arm themselves and meet up for fights. Rival schools are being split into coloured red and blue teams and given dates for suggested clashes, a point system for violent acts, and in some cases mentions blades and weapons. The trend, seen as platforms like TikTok and Snapchat, have alarmed head teachers from the Black Country schools and have alerted parents after learning pupils might be planning to attend school wars with knives. A spokesperson from West Midlands Police said that they were aware of reports suggesting children from some schools are planning to take part in organised fights. "We're speaking to schools locally and offering them support where necessary. We'd urge parents to speak to their children around the use of social media." Letters have been sent to parents at a number of schools warning them to be alert of the risks and ensure their children are safe. Henry Holland, principal at Grace Academy Darlston in Wednesbury, said, "As an academy, we do not condone this behaviour and any students who chooses to become involved may receive serious consequences." Schools named in the red versus blue posts also includes the Walsall Studio School, Sandwell Academy and Plantsbrook School, Morstan Pool, Hayes Academy, Heath Park, Highfields, Wednesbury Academy, Moseley, Ormiston SWB Academy, West Walsall E Act Academy, Willenhall E Act Academy and Wood Green Academy. The post suggests that these fights will take place at venues in Walsall and Wolverhampton, including Walsall Arboretum and in Heath Town Park.
Hi, this is Debbie with some articles from the Express and Star from the 5th of March. Big supermarket changes shoppers can expect this year. After crazes from protein-packed food to Dubai chocolate took over supermarket shelves in 2025, experts tell us what we can look forward to in 2026. Whether you're happy to splash the cash at a fancy Waitrose or like to keep those purse strings nice and tight at your nearest Aldi or Lidl, retail experts reckon we can all expect to see some major changes on supermarket shelves in 2026. A host of new trends made waves in 2025, such as foods high in protein and viral flavours like Dubai chocolate. So what should we expect this year? And with greater awareness around how ultra-processed foods can affect gut health, products that boost well-being should also be making an appearance in more supermarket trolleys. The experts believe shoppers are comparing prices more than ever before, with supermarkets hearing this loud and clear. Big names such as Tesco have widened their own label range, for example. But cost isn't the only thing influencing what we will see on the shop shelves. Protein has been one of the biggest wellness crazes in recent years, with gym goers in particular becoming hyper aware of how much of it they were consuming each day. This year, fibre is expected to be the macronutrient on everyone's mind. In fact, Waitrose's 2026 food and drink report found that getting enough fibre is the biggest concern of health-conscious consumers. Fibre, in many ways, is becoming more important than protein in the eyes of consumers, says Joe Wolfe, owner of food marketing firm The Discovery Stand. A recent YouGov/AHDB survey found 26% of UK consumers plan to reduce their consumption of ultra-processed foods this year, with 13% planning to up their fibre intake. There's a real shift towards fibre-rich, gut-friendly foods and plant-based options that don't feel like a compromise, said Caroline Morris, sales director at barbecue retailer Barbequick. This shift towards more nutrients like fibre is already evident at Marks & Spencer, which is leading the charge with its new nutrient-dense range. A hot contender for trolley space in 2026 is good-quality frozen food. Gone are the days of frozen food having a bad name, as this whole sector has firmly shaken off its old reputation, says Morris. Premium frozen products are booming as consumers look to save time without sacrificing quality or flavour. This shift is evident in Waitrose, where specialist frozen items such as pastries and high-end potatoes soared by 322% in a year. Tesco also recently revamped its frozen food offering for the first time since 2018, expanding its finest frozen range with new pizzas, pies, poultry and fish. With demand for these products growing, consumers can expect other supermarkets to follow suit. David Kindness of bestmoney.com says frozen vegetables will also rise in popularity as they are cheaper but just as nutrient dense as fresh produce, particularly with fibre. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph of a freezer cabinet showing a range of foods. Ex-Albion player denies breaching order. Former England and West Brom footballer Andy Carroll has denied breaching a non-molestation order by allegedly repeatedly calling his reality TV star ex-wife. The former striker, who played 15 times for West Bromwich Albion in 2022, indicated a not guilty plea to the charge at Chelmsford Magistrates Court. Carroll is charged with breaching the order made by the family court at Chelmsford Justice Centre by allegedly repeatedly calling in March last year his ex-wife Billy Mucklow, who is featured on the reality TV show The Only Way is Essex. The 37-year-old, who currently plays for National League South club Dagenham and Redbridge, played 9 matches for England between 2010 and 2012, scoring twice, including one goal at Euro 2012. Wearing a green coat and using crutches with a foot brace on his left foot, Carroll spoke only to confirm his name, address and date of birth at the brief hearing yesterday. Asked if he would like to be tried in a magistrate's or Crown Court, Carroll said, "Crown, please." District Judge Roy Brown bailed Carroll and he will next appear at Chelmsford Crown Court on March the 4th. The judge told Carroll, "Your next appearance at court will be at Chelmsford Crown Court on March the 4th for a plea and trial preparation hearing." A local history society in the Black Country is holding a series of talks as it celebrates its 30th anniversary. The Oldbury Company, which glazed the Crystal Palace and the clock face of Old Ben, the role of DNA testing in family history research, and an Edwardian literary tramp are among the stories that will be covered by Langley and Oldbury Local History Society over the coming months. Chairman Rob Broadbent said the group began in 1996 as a series of reminiscence sessions at Langley Library. This led to a smaller booklet to be followed by other books, including ones on the area's industry, leisure and shops over the previous century. A similar group was started at Oldbury Library, but when the venue closed in 2019, its members joined the Langley Group, and the name was recently changed to Langley and Oldbury Local History Society. Members meet on the second Wednesday of each month at the Royal British Legion Club in Windsor Road, Oldbury, at 10:30 a.m. Karen Evans gives the next talk on March 11th about using DNA testing to discover where one's family comes from. In April, Gillian White will talk about the 1346 Battle of Crecy. May's speaker will be retired schoolteacher and author Quinton Watt on the adventures of Harry Payne, a partially sighted vagrant who earned a living travelling around Britain, writing reviews for local newspapers of the places he visited. On June the 10th, author and Black Country Living Museum expert Simon Briarcliffe will talk about the Black Country in the post-war years, while on August the 12th, Mr. Broadbent talked about the Battle of Kohima. The origins of artificial intelligence this September, followed by Henry Chance on his family's role in Oldbury's glass industry. For more details, email langleyhistorysociety@gmail.com. No expense spared when the baggies hit the road. This article is accompanied by a two-colour photograph. One shows a man standing inside a luxury coach. The caption reads, "Nathan Hadley, MD at Prospect Coaches in Lye, inside the luxury coach." And the other photograph shows the same man wearing sunglasses standing outside. This caption reads, "Prospect Coaches won the contract to transport WBA players last year." The article's by Beverly Rademacher. A family-run Black Country coach company has given a sneak peek inside its most state-of-the-art passenger vehicle, which transports West Bromwich Albion players to and from football matches around the country. Prospect Coaches won the contract last summer to provide transportation for WBA players, including the men's and women's first teams, in its luxury Irizar i8 premium high-deck coach. Designed for long-distance touring and corporate services, the vehicle, which was made in Spain, has been kitted out with everything a travelling elite sports team could require. The £500,000 coach boasts luxurious leather-free seats that are only seen in high-end vehicles, along with high-tech adjustable tables, so the players can enjoy a sit-down dinner while on the road. There are TVs throughout the bus, a proper coffee machine, toilet facilities, plus a physiotherapy table, should anyone need help to recover after a match. What's most impressive, though, is the full professional kitchen situated at the back of the coach, which boasts two ovens and a state-of-the-art microwave that can even cope with heating metal trays. The setup comes with a professional chef on board to cook the players a top-quality nutritious meal after each game to ensure they have the fuel needed to stay in peak condition for the next match. The high-tech vehicle is one of five team coaches owned by Prospect Coaches, which is headquartered in Lye. It also transports the Wolves women's team and Kidderminster Harriers first team to games around the country, along with a host of other local football teams, including Stourbridge FC and their supporters. Nathan Hadley, Managing Director of Prospect Coaches, said, "Not many coaches will have a kitchen. The club has had the two rational ovens installed with the belief that there's a 10% gain in the performance of the players from the nutritional value that can be provided by the chef that travels on board and prepares a meal for all the players post-game." He said he and his wife, Claire Hadley-King, designed the colour scheme for the luxury seats, adding, "My wife is very much not a fan of leather, so we have a fabric called Ultra Fabrics, and he's one of the first coaches, or the first coach, in the country with this material." Nathan took over the driver's seat after the sudden death of his mother, Roz, in June 2024. He said Mum was famously a West Bromwich Albion fan and loved to wind up the rest of the family who went. Roz, who was a female powerhouse in the coach industry, is also commemorated with a blue plaque on the wall of the Prospect Coaches HQ in Leigh High Street. Two teens deliberately knocked off electric bike. This article is accompanied by a colour photograph showing an empty stretch of road which has been cordoned off with police tape. In the middle of the road is a car and on the side of the road is a bus stop. The caption reads, "A large cordon was in place around Clark's Lane, West Bromwich," by Daniel Walton. Two teenagers have been left with serious injuries following a crash near a school in West Bromwich. West Midlands Police have confirmed that an investigation has been launched after two teenagers were knocked off an electric bike in Clark's Lane, West Bromwich, on Tuesday afternoon. Emergency services were called to the lane near Phoenix Collegiate at around 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday afternoon. Two teenagers, both male, aged 18 and 16, were confirmed to be the rider and passenger of the bike and were left with injuries that were described as life-changing. West Midlands Police has now launched an appeal for information following the crash. The force is asking anyone with information to contact them directly via their 101 number, quoting reference 20/166729/26. A force spokesperson said, "We are investigating after two teenagers were believed to be deliberately knocked off an electric bike in West Bromwich by a car. We were called to Clark's Lane shortly before 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday afternoon. Two teenagers, both male, aged 18 and 16, were taken to hospital with injuries described as potentially life-changing. Two ambulances, a Merritt trauma doctor and a critical care paramedic, attended the scene where on arrival they found two male patients who were said to be the driver and passenger of a bike. Both were assessed for serious injuries, receiving advanced trauma care at the scene before being conveyed to hospital for further treatment." A West Midlands Ambulance Service spokesperson said, "We were called at 4:25 p.m. on Tuesday to a road traffic collision involving a car and a bike on Clark's Lane, West Bromwich. Two ambulances and a Merritt trauma doctor and critical care paramedic attended the scene. Upon arrival, we found two male patients who were the driver and passenger on the bike. Both were assessed by ambulance staff and had sustained serious injuries. They received advanced trauma care at the scene before being conveyed to the hospital for further treatment. No further patients required treatment. A large cordon was in place with buses diverted away from the scene at the time." Mr. Michael Smith, head teacher at Phoenix Collegiate, said, "I cannot comment on the incident at Clark's Lane as there is an ongoing police investigation. However, I can categorically say that this was completely unrelated to the school. The school remains open and support is in place for any witnesses to the awful incident that have unfolded on the road. Our thoughts are with the two youths and their families and we wish them a speedy recovery. My thanks also go to our staff who stopped and provided support, as well as a number of students who also went to help or came into school to call for help after being in revision sessions until after 4 p.m. shortly before the incident occurred."
Hello, this is Lauren with some stories from the Express and Star from the 6th of March. Councillor quits party after row, written by Mark Andrews. The winner of a shock by-election in Walsall has been suspended by Reform UK just 6 months after his election victory in a row over clipboards. Councillor Graham Eardley was elected as the Reform candidate in the traditional Conservative stronghold of Pelsall in September last year. It is understood that the suspension relates to a complaint from a party volunteer alleging aggressive behaviour. He denies any wrongdoing. He told the Express and Star that he had resigned with immediate effect and was now a member of Rupert Lowe's rivals Restore Britain party. He said his suspension related to an argument about clipboards at a party event where Reform Deputy Leader Richard Tice was appearing. Councillor Eardley said that a fellow party member had accused him of misappropriating branch assets after losing track of six clipboards which had been purchased for his by-election campaign. A statement from Reform UK said, "Graham Eardley has been suspended from Reform UK with immediate effect, pending investigation." A source inside the party said Councillor Eardley had to be escorted from a building by security following the altercation. Councillor Eardley said the allegation was nonsense, adding, "I was provoked into shouting by the complainant. There is history between us." Councillor Eardley won last year's by-election, caused by the sudden resignation of former council leader Gary Perry, by 55 votes over Conservative candidate Lee Chapman. Councillor Eardley was first elected as a Conservative councillor in the 1990s, but later defected to the UK Independence Party. Following his victory on September 11th, Councillor Eardley said it showed there was no such thing as a safe seat in the borough. Council and housing provider are planning to build new flats. Written by Christian Barnett, local democracy reporter. A council is set to buy a garden centre and a former police station to make way for 50 new flats. Sandwell Council said it will be working with affordable housing provider Cornerstone Housing to buy two sites, including the former Smethwick Police Station and the Greenleaves Garden Centre in Blackheath Town Centre, as part of plans to build around 50 one- and two-bed flats. A report, which will be discussed by the Labour-led authority next week, said the garden centre in Halesowen Street, Blackheath, would be demolished to make way for around 22 new flats, and the former Smethwick Police Station in Piddock Road would be refurbished and converted into between 28 and 31 one- and two-bed flats. The Cabinet report said, "These schemes could deliver approximately 50 homes for affordable rent as part of the Council's wider priority to provide affordable, high-quality housing to contribute to addressing local housing need and the number of people on the waiting list for a council home. The proposed development site on the corner of Hornaway and Halesowen Street, Blackheath, is currently in use as an operating garden centre, Greenleaves Garden Centre and Interior Plants. Whilst not within the designated boundary of Blackheath Town Centre, the site is in very close proximity to the Britannia Pub and Sainsbury's Supermarket, both of which are visible from the site. The site is in a sustainable location for future residential development. Both locations are well connected to public transport, services and town centre amenities. Cornerstone is progressing land acquisition, with planning applications anticipated in spring 2026 and determination expected in autumn 2026. Subject to approvals, construction would commence in late 2026 or early 2027, with anticipated handover in spring 2028. Cornerstone Housing has already agreed terms to buy the former Smethwick Police Station, and contracts will need to be exchanged by the end of the month as part of the agreement. Sandwell Council said there was an informal agreement in place between Cornerstone and the owners of the Greenleaves Garden Centre to buy the site, and it is expected to be formalised soon. Sandwell Council's Cabinet meets in Albury on March 11th to make a decision. Alongside the article is a picture of the Smethwick Police Station. It is an old building made of orange brick. It's quite grand,
with lots of chimneys and kind of ornamental decoration on the roof. It has railings going all around it, lots of windows, and a bright blue police station door. It's captioned, "The former Smethwick Police Station in Piddock Road." Picture from Google Maps. New Peaky Blinders at its explosive best. This film is mesmerising, bold, brilliant, intense, incredible. Written by Fionnuala Bourke. Peaky Blinders Review. The Peaky Blinders movie is finally here. Fans across the globe have been waiting patiently for the hotly anticipated return of the Shelby clan, this time appearing on the big screen, and we got to see the incredible world premiere. The Peaky Blinders phenomenon, created by Stephen Knight, has been one of the most exciting things ever to happen to the West Midlands. Tommy Shelby is a total legend, and the TV series shot Birmingham and the region into the global stratosphere like never before. Now the iconic story continues, as a film, and it's an explosion of magnificence and emotion with a touch of gypsy magic. I don't want to spoil anyone's experience by giving away the full storyline, but be prepared for an emotional roller coaster. And I'm pretty sure that even if you haven't watched all the previous episodes or genned up on key points in the story, which begins in 1919 and has now reached 1940, you'll still enjoy it. I could have sat for another 10 hours watching Cillian Murphy, Stephen Graham, Rebecca Ferguson, Tim Roth, Barry Keoghan, to mention just a few of the big names in the movie, and the latest trials and tribulations to hit the city's most famous gangster clan. It's totally mesmerising, bold, brilliant, intense, incredible, and so much more. The haunting music, sensational fashion, quite a few massive explosions, and a grippy storyline captivated the audience at Birmingham Symphony Hall at the ICC from start to finish on Monday night, ahead of its release in cinemas last night. The story picks up from the end of Series 6, when our Tommy was last seen burning down his caravan to start a new life back in the 1930s. He was never destined to be a normal mortal man, we have been told. And we meet the gangster chief again in the movie, once more played perfectly by Cillian Murphy. And this time World War II is underway and Birmingham is under siege. It's been billed as Tommy Shelby's most destructive reckoning yet, so there was a lot to live up to. You may have seen the trailer where Ada Shelby, Sophie Rundle, warns her brother, that is, illegitimate gypsy son Duke, played by Barry Keoghan, is running the Peaky Blinders like it's 1919 all over again. She's not wrong. Duke is certainly putting it about in true Shelby fashion when we meet him on screen, although the violence wasn't too graphic, you may be pleased to hear. Tommy takes a bit of persuading to come out of his self-imposed exile and make it back to Birmingham, but with the help of Carlo, a new character played by Rebecca Ferguson, he finally shows up in the garrison. Meanwhile, baddie extraordinaire Beckett, a terrifying make-believe fascist sympathiser played by Tim Roth, is trying his hardest to lure Duke into maybe the most dangerous ever plot yet to face the Shelby clan. "The world don't give an F about me," says Duke, "and I don't give an F about the world." It's a dynamite concoction of calamity. But there's some humour in this story too. Don't worry about being terrified all the way through. It's full of emotion, remember, and you'll want to laugh as well as cry as the story unfolds. I was particularly touched by the real-life historic touchpoints which paid tribute to the everyday people of Birmingham. Director Tom Harper spoke of how wonderful it was to make the movie on the streets of Birmingham, saying, "When you're on the streets of Digbeth or Small Heath, that is the place where the myth of the Peaky Blinders was born. Don't forget to look out for local landmarks too. The Black Country Living Museum once again gets a starring role in The Immortal Man. The BCLM's historic boat dock appeared as Charlie Strong's yard in all 6 of the show's series. Film crews also captured scenes by the canal at Bumble Hole Nature Reserve in the Netherton area of Dudley. Filming for the Netflix movie also taken place at Stephen Knight's Digbeth Lock Studios, Digbeth and by the canals off Gas Street in Birmingham city centre. Alongside this article is a picture of Rebecca Ferguson as Kaolu in the new film. She is stood in an abandoned industrial yard. The background is blurred, but we can see two warehouses and one metal structure completely on fire after an explosion. She stands in the forefront of the picture. She has long, brown, wavy hair, is wearing a leather blazer, and is stood staring off to something in the distance. It's captioned, "Peaky Blinders, the Immortal Man." Rebecca Ferguson as Kaolu in the new Netflix production filmed in our region.
Hello, this is Sobjit with your news from The Express and Star. Saturday, 7 March. £800,000 saved as Unlucky 13 prosecuted over blue badge infringements. A council has saved taxpayers more than £800,000 after a crackdown on blue badge fraudsters led to 13 prosecutions. Sandwell Council's enforcement team stopped 24 people from fraudulently using the parking badge, which is meant to help residents with disability issues leave their vehicles close to location points. The council has also successfully taken 13 of those stopped to court. The figures have been released in the council's Audit Risk and Assurance Committee's annual counter-fraud report. In one case, an individual was found to be misusing a badge which belonged to an elderly relative. The man was using the badge to park while at work. He subsequently pleaded guilty to a road traffic offence of misusing a blue badge and was fined £120, as well as being ordered to repay costs of £350. In a separate case, a benefit cheat who fraudulently obtained direct payments, resulting in an overpayment of £27,500, was also convicted. In January, the male resident was sentenced at Birmingham Crown Court after pleading guilty to an offence of fraud under the Fraud Act 2006. He was jailed for 2 years, suspended for 21 months. In his case, the council is also attempting to recoup the man's ill-gotten gains under the Proceeds of the Crime Act. Committee Chairman Councillor Liam Preece said, "Fraud now represents over 40% of all crime nationally, so the council has stepped up its actions to stop these criminals stealing from Sandwell taxpayers. I hope the work of our dedicated anti-fraud officers makes any fraudster thinking about stealing from residents of our borough that we are watching and waiting to stop you in your tracks." Sandwell's finance boss, Councillor Paul Moore, added, "The amount of money involved in these thefts only gives us greater resolve to support our teams of investigators and to work with West Midlands Police and to support the Cabinet Office's National Fraud Initiative. We need to be clear. Fraud against the council is theft from every Sandwell resident, and we will use the full force of the law to stop it," he added. The council was previously shortlisted in the Breakout Award category at the British Parking Awards for its efforts in cracking down on blue badge misuse and fraud. Anyone wishing to report any suspected fraud in the borough can do so by emailing fraud_investigation@sandwell.gov.uk or by calling 0121 569 2650. £1.5 million will be spent on 25 new special education needs places. Government cash will be used to improve facilities for youngsters at two schools, by Christian Barnett, local democracy reporter. As much as £1.5 million will be spent creating 25 new SEND places at two schools in Sandwell. Sandwell Council said it plans to use the government money to improve facilities for children with special education needs and disabilities, known as SEND, at Ocker Hill Academy in Tipton and Wood Green Academy in Wensbury. The council was given £1.6 million by the Department for Education as part of government plans to expand and improve SEND provision. Both schools have also been included in the DfE's school rebuilding programme, and both sites are expected to be comprehensively redeveloped. Sandwell Council's Cabinet meets on March 11 to discuss the SEND proposals. A total of £400,000 will be spent on Ocker Hill Academy in Gospel Oak Road to provide 5 extra spaces for children, and £1.11 million will be spent at Wood Green Academy to create a further 20 spaces. The 240-place Ocker Hill Academy currently supports 10 pupils with social, emotional and mental health needs. Wood Green Academy, the 1,300-pupil secondary school in Wood Green Road, Wensbury, does not have a designated SEND resource base, but provides wider support to its pupils who require additional support to meet their needs. SEND children at Ocker Hill Academy are currently accommodated in a former site manager's house. The council said the house was not included within the scope of the Department for Education's replacement work, but provision could remain and increased at the school using the extra funding. Both Ocker Hill Academy and Wood Green Academy have been included within the DfE's National School Rebuild Programme, which will see both school sites comprehensively redeveloped. Mozza can write his greatest chapter in Hawthorn's history. Behind the headlines with Chief Sports Writer and Sports Journalist of the Year, Matt Maher. There is a picture of James Morrison, who has the opportunity to etch his name further into Albion club folklore. Whatever happens over the next 2 months should do nothing to change the huge regard in which James Morrison is held by Albion supporters. Yet, if the 39-year-old succeeds in keeping the Baggies in the Championship, it would surely add the greatest chapter yet to an association with the club, which now stretches back almost 2 decades. A little over a week after ending Eric Ramsey's brief tenure, Albion provided necessary clarity on Wednesday when they confirmed it will be Mozza who has the reins until the end of the season. Russell Martin's longtime assistant, Matt Gill, has joined to add another voice and, more importantly, another pair of eyes to the effort of halting the team's nosedive toward League One. Only the Hawthorns hierarchy will know just how the 7 and a bit days between Ramsey's exit and Morrison's anointment played out. Reports of tentative approaches to Darren Moore and Slaven Bilic, among others, were quickly shot down. The truth is the club's board wouldn't have been doing its duty if it didn't take a breath, step back and see what options might be out there. That said, it was never going to be an easy sell. Albion are far more from sunk, but sure have the look of a team sinking fast. Winless in 11, their last 25 championship matches have delivered just 18 points. That's not a situation too many experienced managers would be willing to inherit, at least not without the kind of financial guarantees which, from the club's perspective, would have made any deal prohibitive. From the moment Ramsey walked out of the Hawthorns for the final time, following a draw with Charlton a week ago last Tuesday, Morrison always looked the most likely short-term successor. There was never any chance he would refuse the challenge. A 2-time promotion winner with 341 first-team appearances to his name, more than 300 of those coming in the Premier League, no one needs reminding of his contribution as a player to the club's most successful era since the 1970s. This is the first time, however, since joining the Baggies as a 20-year-old in August 2007, he has really been placed front and centre. The beauty of the best Albion teams during the club's 8-year-old run in the top flight between 2010 and 2018 was the fact that they were just that, teams. Morrison, who moved from the wing to the heart of midfield under Roy Hodgson, was one of several key cogs, player of the season in the 2014-15 season, but perhaps never what you would describe as the star man. As a player and personality, he wasn't particularly the type you would immediately pick out as future management material. Yet the game's long list of great captains who have proven abject failures in the dugout demonstrates just how tough a judgment that is to make. What has never been in doubt has been Morrison's desire to win, or perhaps put more accurately, hatred of losing. This is a man, remember, who first announced himself to the wider football world by scything down Cristiano Ronaldo in the dying moments of an FA Cup tie, who would later punch Albion teammate Saido Berahino in the dressing room after the latter had lost possession, allowing Swansea to equalise late in a 3-3 draw at the Hawthorns. Success in management may depend on tempering those emotions, though early indications suggest Morrison's no-nonsense spirit will remain very much part of his makeup. The Scotland international was scathing in his assessment of Albion's players after last weekend's 2-1 defeat at Oxford. At the time, with the club's immediate direction still up in the air, there was a temptation to see Morrison's words as those of an interim who believed the match at the Kassam Stadium as his one and only hit. Perhaps, on the other hand, they were words he simply felt needed saying. After all, he is the third head coach attempting to inject some fight into a group which has so far failed to answer the call of a relegation battle. Whatever has been tried so far simply hasn't worked. All the same, such public tongue lashings always carry an element of risk. It is not a tactic which can be used often, or else it quickly loses impact. We shall get the first indication of just how effective Morrison's use was when Albion travelled to Sheffield United on Saturday. With still almost a quarter of the campaign to play, the trip to Bramall Lane does not quite fall into must-win territory for the Baggies, yet having not tasted victory in the Championship since December 29 and not on the road since October 1, there's no telling what impact a positive result could have. This was not a situation Albion's management expected to be in last summer, nor was it one they anticipated in January, as evidenced by the foolhardy move for Ramsey. Morrison is now tasked with finding the short-term fix the former couldn't. Never has he faced such a challenge. Never has his chance to change the course of club history been so great. Alan Pardew thinks there should be an asterisk next to Arsenal's name if they win the Premier League title, because they're not particularly easy on the eye. There's nothing beautiful about them, he declared this week on national radio. Is that the same Alan Pardew who won just 3 out of 21 matches in charge of Albion, who took a team from just above the Premier League relegation zone to 10 points adrift of safety, whose 4-month reign will forever be best remembered for a booze-fueled mid-season trip to Barcelona, where 4 players stole a taxi? Is it that Alan Pardew? It is. Just checking. Pensioners turn Town Hall into a Peaky Blinders bonanza. There are a few photographs of the pensioners gathered at Wensbury Town Hall for a Peaky Blinders event by Mimi Abraham. around 170 pensioners gathered at Wainsbury Town Hall for a Peaky Blinders event. Visitors to the Let's Dance Again event at Wainsbury Town Hall, dressed as Peaky Blinders on Thursday, March 5, to celebrate the new Peaky Blinders, the Immortal Man film. We've got 170 pensioners all dressed up in their gear. We've got people from the Black Country Museum, we've got Polly, we've got the lookalikes, said Elaine Costigan, who is the chair and a lead volunteer of Let's Dance Again. The charity is one that provides social activities and support for the elderly community. At this year's event, Peaky Blinders was on everyone's mind due to the new film. Everybody is dressed up and it's just honestly, it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant, Elaine said. Geraldine Jennings, who is a professional Polly Gray lookalike, marvelled at the electric atmosphere where she arrived at Wainsbury Town Hall. She shared, "Every time I come to one of these events, I always expect it to be spectacular. But this particular event, the energy is electric in here today. Not only is the room dressed beautifully, but everybody attending has made an fantastic effort. They all look so beautiful and everyone is pleased to see us. I'm very happy to be here." Geraldine was impressed by the original outfits that some of the elderly women were wearing. She said, "Just talking to a few of the lovely ladies and they've brought some of the original wares that their mothers and their grandmothers had as well." Similarly, Paul O'Riordan, who's a professional Arthur Shelby lookalike, shared how he was impressed by the effort made by those in attendance. He said, "I was well impressed how the elders have all dressed up and made an effort. It's bang on." Mr. O'Riordan, who is the landlord at the King's Arms in Tipton, touted his strong resemblance to the famed character. "Everyone thinks I am him. If you see me, then you'll be gobsmacked." The charity holds monthly events at Wainsbury Town Hall, as well as hosting weekly coffee mornings on Monday mornings. Campaign is launched to get red squirrel emoji. A petition has been launched calling for the creation of a red squirrel emoji as part of efforts to raise awareness for one of the UK's most endangered native mammals. The campaign, led by the Wildlife Trusts and Centre Parks, say that introducing the animal to the emoji library could help it remain visible in everyday conversations, particularly among younger audiences communicating through digital platforms. It comes after a census-wide survey of 2,000 UK children aged 8 to 15 found that 34% did not know red squirrels lived in the UK, and 33% were unaware or not sure whether the species was endangered here. Elsewhere, it found that 10% were unable to correctly identify the red squirrel from photographs, often confusing it with the more common grey squirrel. And 2/3 of British children were found to wrongly believe red squirrels can still be seen all over the UK. Immortalised in the Beatrix Potter book, The Tale of Squirrel Nutkin, and a long-standing symbol of Britain's woodlands, the reddish-brown species has suffered rapid population declines in recent decades. Numbers have declined from an estimated 3.5 million in the UK 150 years ago to as low as 120,000 today, with red squirrels now only found at a handful of locations in the UK. This has been driven by habitat loss and the introduction of the invasive grey squirrels from North America, which carry the squirrel pox virus. There is currently no squirrel emoji available for smartphone users around the world, only the North American chipmunk. The census-wide survey commissioned by Centre Parks found that 86% of British children believe the chipmunk emoji is a squirrel. Richard Watson, Ecology and Biodiversity Manager at Centreparks, said, "If children can instantly recognise animals through the modern language of emojis they use every day, that visibility can spark curiosity, conversation, and ultimately, care." The Holiday Village operator manages its Windfell Forest site in Cumbria as a red squirrel conservation area and says conservation efforts have helped drive a steady population rise in the area over 25 years, with a 24% increase in sightings reported last year. Heather Harris, Red Squirrel Recovery Network Communications Officer at the Wildlife Trust for Lancashire, Manchester and North Merseyside, said, "Spotting the russet fur and fluffy ear tufts of a red squirrel as it dashes through the trees is a delight and one that more of us should have the chance to enjoy. Populations of the animal have radically decreased."
Hello again, everybody. This is Rosie and I'm reading the pub quiz for you again this week, and we're going to mix it up again with three different sections. The first is the news section, then I'll read some in Remember When, and then the third section will be Who Am I? Here we go with the first four questions in news. Number one, the late Queen's christening gown is to go on display for the first time. How many royal babies was it worn by? Two, which country in the Middle East stopped the production of liquefied natural gas, causing prices to rocket? Three, which beer maker is to shut 38 bars after they were not included in a £33 million rescue deal? Number four, what, bearing a livery featuring a flat cap-wearing Cillian Murphy as Tommy Shelby, has been unveiled in Birmingham? The second section is Remember When, and we'll have three questions here. So, do you remember when Hong Kong reverted to Chinese sovereignty, Katrina and the Waves won the Eurovision Song Contest, the English Patient won 9 Oscars, and Bill Clinton was inaugurated as US President for a second term? And the second question, Edward Heath imposed direct rule for Ulster, Bobby Fischer became world chess champion, Sir John Betjeman became poet laureate, Munich hosted the Summer Olympic Games. And the last one in this section, do you remember when the 4 Britons held in the Libyan hostage situation were released? Ruth Lawrence got a first at Oxford, aged 13. Barry McGuigan won the world featherweight boxing title, and the Greenpeace ship, the Rainbow Warrior, was sunk in Auckland, New Zealand. And the last round of Who Am I is the first of three questions. A cult writer, I was born in Kentucky in 1937. My signature style of gonzo journalism saw me rise to popularity as a chronicler of American counterculture, a reputation which was enhanced in 1972 with the publication of my autobiographical novel, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And the second, Who Am I? I'm an actress. I was born in Canada in 1948. I appeared in low-budget Canadian films in the late 1960s, but started getting bigger roles in the 1970s and was leading lady to Gene Wilder and Robert Redford. I'm best remembered for playing Lois Lane to Christopher Reeve's Superman in the 1970s and 80s. And the last one, number three. I am a singer. I was born in Texas in 1982. I once worked as an extra for the hit children's show Sabrina the Teenage Witch. I won the first series of American Idol, and my first single sold nearly 240,000 copies in 1 week. My subsequent hits have included Miss Independent and Since You've Been Gone. I hope you did well with those, and here are the questions this time along with the answers. To the news section, number one. The late Queen's christening gown is to go on display for the first time. How many royal babies was it worn by? And it has been worn by a remarkable 62. Number two. Which country in the Middle East stopped the production of liquefied natural gas, causing prices to rocket? And that was Qatar. Number three. Which beer maker is to shut 38 bars after they were not included in a £33 million rescue deal? And that was BrewDog. Number four. What, bearing a livery featuring a cap-wearing Cillian Murphy as Tommy Shelby, has been unveiled in Birmingham? And that's a tram. The second section, questions with answers in the Remember When section. Do you remember when Hong Kong reverted to Chinese sovereignty? Katrina and the Waves won the Eurovision Song Contest. The English Patient won 9 Oscars. And Bill Clinton was inaugurated as US President for a second term. And that was in 1997. Number two. Do you remember when Edward Heath imposed direct rule for Ulster? Bobby Fischer became world chess champion. Sir John Betjeman became poet laureate. And Munich hosted the Summer Olympic Games. And that was in 1972. And the third one. Do you remember when the 4 Britons held in the Libyan hostage situation were released? Ruth Lawrence got a first at Oxford, aged 13. Barry McGuigan won the world featherweight boxing title. And the Greenpeace ship, the Rainbow Warrior, was sunk in Auckland, New Zealand. That was 1985. And the third section of Who Am I? I am a cult writer. I was born in Kentucky in 1937. My signature style of gonzo journalism saw me rise to popularity as a chronicler of American counterculture, a reputation which was enhanced in 1972 with the publication of my autobiographical novel, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I am Hunter S. Thompson. Number two. I am an actress. I was born in Canada in 1948. I appeared in low-budget Canadian films in the late 1960s, but started getting bigger roles in the 1970s and was leading lady to Gene Wilder and Robert Redford. I'm best remembered for playing Lois Lane to Christopher Reeve's Superman in the 1970s and 80s. And I am Margot Kidder. And the third and last one. I am a singer. I was born in Texas in 1982. I once worked as an extra on the hit children's show Sabrina the Teenage Witch. I won the first series of American Idol and my first single sold nearly 240,000 copies in 1 week. My subsequent hits have included Miss Independent and Since You Been Gone. And I am Kelly Clarkson. I hope you all did really well this week. Bye for now.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Now for the audio described TV programmes for the week beginning Saturday 14th of March and ending Friday 20th of March 2026, written by John and read by Diane. Saturday the 14th. A view of Hampton Court Gardens could start your spring week of television with Raymond Blanc's Royal Kitchen Gardens on ITV1 at 12:15 this morning. There's live coverage of the Winter Paralympics on Channel 4 at 12:30. ITV1 is showing the Rugby Union Six Nations match between Ireland and Scotland at 1 o'clock. It's not audio described, but the commentary should keep you in touch with the game. There's an animated adventure on BBC One at 1:55 with the film Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. There's a roundup of meals from the Great British Menu starting at 2:30 with starters and canapés, then 3:30 a look at main courses and desserts, both programmes on BBC Two. BBC One is showing the Six Nations match between Wales and Italy at 4 p.m. and the third Six Nations match of the day is between France and England and is on ITV One at 7:20. Neither of these matches are audio described, but again, the commentary should help. Jan tries to push Teddy to settle things with Jacob, and Kim seeks to prove herself with a former tutor. All will be revealed in Casualty on BBC One at 8:15. Alice Roberts gets to her penultimate destination of Nîmes in France on her journey through the Roman Empire by train on Channel 4 at 8:15. And then Bill Bailey's Vietnam continues on Channel 4 at 9:15 as he heads to the mountainous area of Da Lat. Although not audio described, much of the day is on BBC One at 10:20. Now on to Sunday, 15th. More politicians are put under the spotlight on BBC One at 9 a.m. in Sunday with Laura Kunzberg. The final day of the Winter Paralympics, starting with the men's vision-impaired alpine skiing slalom. The coverage starts at 7:50 a.m. and concludes at 1 p.m. Do you love your garden? Well, the team today are creating a secluded secret garden in Wakefield. Find out how they get on at 1:10 on ITV1. More Winter Olympics. The closing ceremony is on Channel 4 starting at 7 p.m. It's a new state series starting on BBC One at 8 p.m, The Other Bennett Sister, based on Janice Hadlow's novel. This follows on from Pride and Prejudice and tells the story of Mary, who feels like a wallflower compared to her more showy sisters. Alternatively, if you're interested in wildlife, there's Big Cats 24/7, where you can follow lions, cheetahs and leopards in the Okavango Delta. This is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. The detective drama The Capture continues on BBC One at 9. D.I. Carey takes matters into her own hands and seeks an unlikely ally. An alternative thriller at 9 on ITV1 is Gone. Annie finds a new suspect who has a connection to school. A sci-fi film could end your day with The Martian on BBC Two at 10. An astronaut is stranded on Mars and has to survive on very meagre resources. Now a look at programmes that are on at the same time each weekday. The following are BBC One: Crime Watch Live at 10:45, Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30, Bargain Hunt at 12:15, Bear Grylls Wild Reckoning at 2 p.m. but not Friday, Amanda and Alan's Spanish Job at 2:30 but not Friday, Escape to the Country at 3 p.m. but at 2:45 on Friday, The Repair Shop on the Road at 3:45. Now, other channels. Two episodes of Heartbeat on ITV3 starting at 5:50 and 6:55 p.m. The soaps are EastEnders on BBC One Monday to Thursday at 7:30. Emmerdale on ITV1 at 8 all week. Coronation Street on ITV1 at 8:30 all week. Now back to the weekdays, starting with Monday the 16th. It's brain-teasing time of the week with Mastermind and University Challenge on BBC Two at 8 and 8:30 respectively. Would you like to reduce your kitchen costs and reduce the sugar in your meals? Channel 4 at 8 has the programme for you, Batch from Scratch, Cooking for Less. This menu includes smoky bean cobbler and chicken parmigiana. Then there's more cooking at 9. MasterChef The Professionals is on BBC One, where the semi-finals begin. Find out which couples stay together when they enjoy canal trips, camping and a seaside fun fair whilst handcuffed together. Handcuffed Last Pair Standing is on Channel 4 at 9. Also at 9, Annie and the team see things in a new light as fresh information emerges. This is in Gone on ITV1 at 9. The bottled profits are looking unwell and all hell breaks out at Marvin Gardens. The concluding part of Small Profits is on BBC Two at 10 p.m. Now on to Tuesday the 17th. A quartet of professional chefs from Wales serve up starters, canapés and fish dishes celebrating the British film industry in tonight's Great British Menu on BBC Two at 7 p.m. Al Marie and her 10-year-old daughter Maria declutter their home to make space for a lodger to help pay the bills, and with help from Stacey and her team. Sort Your Life Out with Stacey Solomon is on BBC One at 8. MasterChef The Professionals continues on BBC One at 9, where the chefs must craft a spectacular dessert with world-class pastry standards. The final four contestants make their last ascent of one of New Zealand's highest peaks in The Summit on ITV One at 9. After being locked in a room for 24 hours with only each other for company, the couples are then tested as to how well they know each other whilst travelling on a Loch Lomond boat trip. Handcuffed the Final is on Channel 4 at 9. Also at 9 is the final part of Katia Adler's look at Europe. She learns about France's generous welfare system and China's growing interest in Spain. Europe on the Edge with Katia Adler is on BBC Two at 9. Now for Wednesday the 18th. Chefs from Wales serve up their mains and desserts celebrating the British film industry in The Great British Menu on BBC Two at 7. An electric guitar once played alongside Ringo Starr, a bangle which has been cracked, a 100-year-old tallet bag and a set of tiles are all in need of help from, you guessed it, the repair shop on BBC One at 8. There's a new crime series on the You and Drama channel, Freeview Channel 20. The mayor dies in the middle of a meeting. Judith, Susie and Bex have to investigate as the Marlowe Murder Club. This is on at 8pm. Lots of choice at 9pm, starting with BBC Two and Hostage. In the final part, John Cantile is seen in a propaganda video which raises suspicion as to which side he is on. Lucinda is missing. Selma dives deeper into her research and uncovers the truth about Elisa. This is in The Stolen Girl on ITV One at 9. Kitchenmaid Emma is still toiling at the Fairleys Yorkshire mansion, fuelled by hope and young Edwin's declaration of love. A Woman of Substance continues on Channel 4 at 9. What started as tragedy on a stoneworks now casts a far darker shadow in the concluding part of Ellis, which is on Channel 5 at 9. Now for Thursday the 19th, the semi-finals continue as the chefs are challenged to make venison smoked on a barbecue and a dessert with 9 complex elements. MasterChef The Professionals, BBC One at 8. Kate and Keith have bought a former hotel in Dunoon to convert into a family home, but will some expensive surprises derail their budget? George Clark's Building Home is on Channel 4 at 8. Alexander Armstrong continues his journey around India by visiting Mumbai and discovers the extraordinary antics of the trapdoor spider. Alexander Armstrong in India is on Channel 5 at 8. The candidates are challenged to redeem themselves with a rerun of the opening programme's task of buying the correct items associated with the area for the least money. This time not Hong Kong, but the Isle of Wight. The Apprentice is on BBC One at 9. This is followed at 10 on BBC Two in The Apprentice Unfinished Business with a review of the discount buying task and events in the boardroom. A pregnant Emma sets up a new life in Armley as a shop assistant where she works tirelessly, worrying about how to support her child. This is in A Woman of Substance, which continues on Channel 4 at 9. Or, if you would like a musical drama, Cabaret, the Oscar-winning film starring Liza Minnelli, is on BBC 4 at 9. Alternatively, you could end the day with the action-adventure film starring Harrison Ford and Sean Connery, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is on ITV One at 10:45. And finally, on to Friday the 20th. A former Hollywood star is killed while filming an advert. Can the priest solve the mystery? Father Brown is on BBC One at 2pm. Tonight is Comic Relief Night and is raising money with the slightly unwieldy slogan, Take Yourself Funny for Money. The evening starts at 7pm. Do you fancy spending your life on the road in a motorhome? If so, have a look inside F1 rising star Ollie Bearman's 1.2 million palace on wheels. Inside the world's most luxurious motorhomes is on Channel 4 at 8. There's a relaxing half-hour fishing in the Peak District with Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing on BBC Two at 8:30. Following his death last month, there's a celebration of the life of Neil Sedaka on BBC Four, starting at 9 with all the music you need, and then at 9:45, that's when the music takes me, and finally at 10:45, Neil Sedaka in concert, a live performance from 1975. Unfortunately, it's not audio described, but if you like his music, this would be a great end to your week. Comic Relief moves to BBC Two at 10, where six comedians try to bank money in The Weakest Link. Or you could end your week reviewing this week's programmes with Gogglebox, where the armchair critics share their opinions on what they've been watching. Find out if you agree on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. We hope you find something of interest in this week's suggestions.
Radio Times listening highlights, Saturday the 14th of March to Friday the 20th of March. Hello, I'm David, and here are some radio highlights for this coming week. I hope you will enjoy the choices I've suggested. Saturday the 14th of March, in Saturday Live on Radio 4, Adrian Childs talks to violinist Nigel Kennedy and musician Jess Mills. Saturday Live is on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. Vintage comedy today is an episode of Beyond Our Ken from 1960 and is on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m, repeated at 8:30 p.m. Today's Radio Times choice is a drama set on a busy labour ward, exploring the fragile trust between patients and medical professions. Secrets and Lies, Candor is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Today's Opera on 3 features a performance of Puccini's Madame Butterfly from the New York Metropolitan Opera and is on Radio 3 at 6 p.m. Another Radio Times choice for today is on Archive on 4, Wilson's Way Out, telling the remarkable tale of Harold Wilson's stepping down as Prime Minister in March 1976. Choice Wilson's Way Out is on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. And there's another vintage comedy, At Home with Hinge and Bracket, an episode from 1990, on Radio 4 Extra at 8 p.m. Sunday the 15th of March. Sunday Worship this week, which is Mothering Sunday, is live from West Presbyterian Church in Ballymena, Northern Ireland. Sunday Worship is on Radio 4 at 8:10 a.m. Radio Times choice today is a drama, My Antonia, from Willa Cather's 1918 novel about pioneer settlers in the American Midwest. My Antonia is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Choral Evensong from the Chapel of New College, Oxford, is on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. And today's vintage comedy is a 1955 episode of Take It From Here with Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, and that's on Radio 4 Extra at 3:30 p.m, repeated at 9:30 p.m. And there's one other Radio Times choice today, which is Swimming with Jimmy, a swimming instructor, and that's on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. Shock and War, Iraq 20 Years On, continues a series from last week where Gordon Carrera continues his assessment of the Iraq War and its fallout. That's on Radio 4 each morning at 11:45 a.m. This week's Composer of the Week is Gaetano Donizetti, one of Italy's most prolific tunesmiths. Composer of the Week is on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. each afternoon. The essay Scotland Rocks, a combination of Scottish landscape and geological history with poetry. Scotland Rocks is on Radio 3 each evening at 9:45 p.m. Book at Bedtime is Banshees, an anthology of short stories by female Irish authors, with tales of mermaids, changelings and banshees from old Irish folklore. Book at Bedtime is on Radio 4 at 10:45 each evening. And one more for music lovers. Scottish singer-songwriter Jacob Allon brings us four personally themed playlists on Six Music. Music Artist in Residence is on BBC Six Music from Monday to Thursday, each morning at 11 a.m. Now on to Monday the 16th of March. Like and subscribe on Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m. explores how YouTube changed the world. It's Time to Review YouTube's Music Revolution is on Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m. And today's Vintage Comedy is a 1975 episode of Dad's Army on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m. repeated at 6:30 p.m. And there's a new series of Unspeakable, the panel game of words with Phil Wang and Susie Dent on Radio 4 after the early evening news at 6:30 p.m. Radio 3 in concert this evening is from the Barbican, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra playing, amongst other things, Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Radio 3 in concert is at its usual time of 7:30 p.m. How did we get here? From Israel's early years to the Six-Day War, with Johnny Diamond and guests, is on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Tuesday, the 17th of March. In Radio Times Choice, A Simple Heart, Julian Barnes reads a translation of Gustave Flaubert's tale Un Cœur Simple, A Simple Heart, is on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 a.m, repeated at 7:30 p.m. Today's Vintage Comedy is a 1959 episode of The Goon Show on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m, repeated at 6:30 p.m. Radio 4 brings you The Counsellor by Abby Walker, when a school counsellor investigates a boy with unnerving powers of persuasion. She risks everything to uncover the truth. The Counsellor is on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Today's concert from Radio 3 is a recording by the Royal Northern Sinfonia at the Glasshouse, Gateshead, and includes Mendelssohn's Scottish Symphony and Prokofiev's Second Violin Concerto. Radio 3 in concert is at 7:30 p.m. Evan Davis's Heat Pump Challenge looks at the challenges the government faces as it seeks to encourage the use of heat pumps. Episode 1 of 3, with the next one on Thursday, The Heat Pump Challenge, is on Radio 4 at 9:30 p.m. And then Wednesday, the 18th of March. Vintage Comedy today is It's Hancock, The Missing Page, an episode from 1960. It's Hancock, The Missing Page, is on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m, repeated at 6:30 p.m. And Choral Evensong today is from St Michael's Church in Barnes, with the choir of Tiffin School, and that's on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. Radio 4 Extra brings you Waverley, a dramatisation of Sir Walter Scott's novel of the 1745 Jacobite Rebellion. Waverley is on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. And a Radio Times Choice recommendation, Money, Influence and the NHS. Dr. Margaret McCartney explores the conflicts of interest in the medical world. Money, Influence and the NHS is on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. And another Radio Times Choice today, Radio 3 in concert brings you a selection of music from the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, and that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then Thursday, the 19th of March, In Our Time on Radio 4 brings you a discussion on Dadaism, the art movement formed in Zurich during the First World War in response to the horror and futility of the conflict. In Our Time, hosted by Misha Glennie, is on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. The Radio Times choice for today is the documentary Europe's Night Train Renaissance Still on Track, and that's on the BBC World Service at 9:30 a.m., repeated at 8:05 p.m. and the second episode of Evan Davis's Heat Pump Challenge is at 4 minutes past midday on Radio 4. For Vintage Comedy Today, BBC Radio 4 Extra brings you The Burkis Way, a collection of comedy sketches at 12:30 p.m, repeated at 6:30 p.m. In the race to control the world, Space Race 2.0, Misha Glennie explores how space is critical for the satellites that enable global communications and navigation. Space Race 2.0 is on Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. And the BBC Symphony Orchestra performs live from the Glasgow City Halls in Radio 3 in concert at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. And now on to Friday, the 20th of March. Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs is former heart surgeon Professor Stephen Westerby, who chooses 8 of his favourite recordings on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. Radio Times Choice, A Dewey Decimal, where Sean Wallace assesses the relevance and efficiency of the library cataloguing system. And you can find A Dewey Decimal on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m, repeated at 4:30 p.m. Another Radio Times Choice, The Food Programme, is Food Processing the Missing Middle. Sheila Dillon finds an industry at a crossroads at a time when national food production has never been more important. The Food Programme is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. Friday night is Music Night, brings another chance to hear a French-themed concert with the BBC Concert Orchestra on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Free Thinking, Oral Tradition and Oracy. This brings an exploration of how oracy is taught and the value of passing on traditional knowledge by the use of songs and poems. Free Thinking is on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. And that concludes my summary of suggested radio listings for this week. I hope you enjoy them.
TNS Soundings.
Sandwell Council is investing over £1 million in a strengthened borough-wide antisocial behaviour service to make it easier for residents to report concerns, access support and see problems resolved more effectively. At the heart of the new service is a single point of contact for ASB, giving residents one clear and consistent front door. Reports will be triaged in a structured way and managed end-to-end by a dedicated borough-wide team, ensuring clear ownership, quicker responses, and more consistent outcomes. The investment represents a significant expansion of Sandwell's ASB workforce, with the number of dedicated officers more than doubling from 17 to 39. The team will respond to a wide range of issues, including nuisance noise, persistent littering, neighbourhood disputes and harassment. While these behaviours are not always criminal, they can have a serious and lasting impact on people's well-being and sense of safety if left unresolved. This enhanced service recognises that tackling antisocial behaviour isn't just about enforcement, it's about preventing harm, repairing relationships and building safer, stronger communities. A restorative approach will support residents to resolve conflicts, take responsibility where harm has occurred, and rebuild relationship where it's safe to do so. The service will also work more closely within neighbourhoods, listening to concerns, understanding local issues and making sure residents feel heard and taken seriously. Councillor Suzanne Hartwell deputy leader and cabinet member for neighbourhoods and community, said, "Residents tell us that antisocial behaviour has a real impact on how safe and supported they feel where they live. This investment is about making the service simpler to access, clearer in its response, and more effective in resolving issues that matter to people. We are not just focused on stopping antisocial behaviour. We want to prevent harm, repair relationships where possible, and strengthen communities. This expanded service, alongside our £1.5 million investment in CCTV in Wednesbury and West Bromwich, shows our commitment to listening to residents, taking action, and ensuring no community is left behind. For find advice on reporting antisocial behaviour in Sandwell at www.sandwell.gov.uk/ASB.
Comedian Johnny believes human performances always beat AI. An article by Ollie Foster, Your World Contributor. A black country comedian says that AI will never replace proper human interaction ahead of his biggest gig to date. Johnny Cole, originally from Wednesbury, is scheduled to continue his long-running tour, Armageddon, another 60-plus shows this March through to November. The comic is set to hit venues all across the country, including venues close to home in the Midlands and Black Country, but also going as far as Sheffield, Oxford and Liverpool, with the tour culminating at Birmingham's Utility Arena. Johnny believes that now is the perfect time to continue his comedy tour, because he says that now is when people need laughter and comedy the most, especially with the dawn of AI. He said, "I think comedy is so successful at the moment because there's a need for it. All different types of backgrounds that need to be catered for. All the performers, yes, ChatGPT can create a track, but seeing a human tell jokes or a human doing something live will become important again. My job is driving people away from politics and all that, and to be silly and to make people forget about it. I think comedy is going to be a big business soon. When I was young, the decision to go into the arts was stupid, but it's a safe bet now." The 47-year-old, who has been doing comedy shows for several years, but recently rose to fame on social media, will also be performing his biggest gig ever on this tour. On November the 3rd, 2026, the Yam Yam comedian, who combines his passion for singing and music with his comedy, will be playing the Utility Arena with an overall capacity for Cole's show of around 8,000 people. His current biggest gig stands to be his show at Wolverhampton Civic Hall in October last year, where there were over 2,000 audience members in attendance. Johnny Cole said, "It's not quite real yet. It will be the biggest show I've ever put on. I'll be doing some extra bits, but truthfully speaking, from my heart, it will be the best performance I've ever done. It will be a big personal achievement, because if I never do anything else again, who knows what will be around the corner. It would just be a dream come true. When Wayne came up with the Birmingham one, the arena one at the end, he said, 'We can do it.' So if he says it can be done, it can be done." Tickets for Johnny's shows can be found on Funny Bee's Knees. I'm going to spell that. FUNNY. BEESENESS.co.uk/Johnny Cole. One in seven shops or cafes has gone cashless. Campaign continues to keep coins and notes as an option. An article by Vicky Shaw, personal finance correspondent. One in seven high street businesses has gone cashless in the past year, according to a new survey. While 77% of small and medium-sized retailers said they accept cash, 14% said they had gone cashless over the previous 12 months, according to the research carried out in September 2025. The survey of more than 1,100 SMEs small and medium-sized enterprises across the UK was carried out for a Keeping Choice Alive report published by the ATM and Cash Access Network Link. The survey indicated that 46% of in-person transactions were still cash-based, and in sectors such as independent retail, cafes and pubs, convenience stores and launderettes, cash usage was constantly above this average. The biggest driver to becoming a cashless business in the survey was fraud prevention, followed by security concerns and a lack of customer demand. Around a fifth of businesses also felt digital payments made bookkeeping and accounting easier to manage. A lack of deposit facilities and the closure of the local bank branch were also highlighted among businesses' considerations. Many branches have closed in the West Midlands in recent years, and the closures are continuing, with Lloyds Bank recently revealing it was to axe a number of branches across the region, as well as in Shropshire and Staffordshire. Four-fifths for businesses say they would value better access to deposit facilities. In the absence of a local bank branch, options open to businesses including post offices and banking hubs, which have been set up in some communities to allow several banks to share a single space. Some businesses also highlighted the cost of handling cash as a concern. Link, which runs thousands of cash machines across the country, continues to campaign for people to have access to cash. It also wants to highlight the benefits of dealing in cash, both for the consumer and businesses. Among businesses that accept cash, nearly half said they actively encourage its use, according to the survey carried out by Focal Data. Avoiding card fees was seen as one of the benefits of accepting cash, along with the liquidity and the speed of transactions. A majority, 53% of businesses surveyed, would support mandating cash acceptance, so that all businesses were forced to keep cash transactions as an option. The report advocated a joined-up approach to tackling crime on the high street to help businesses prevent theft and fraud and help staff feel safer. It also said cash acceptance should be regularly monitored to track where cash is truly usable, not just available. The report was led by Link's Consumer Council and supported by the Federation of Small Businesses, the FSB, the Post Office and PayPoint. Joanna Wallace, chairwoman of Link's Consumer Council, said cash remains the main source of payment for many people, especially the older generation, and that it is important to keep access to it. She said, "It's becoming more common to see a sign next to the till in a shop or cafe saying card only. 20 years ago it may have been cash only. The ways we want to pay are changing and so are the ways we are able to pay. This research shows the complex range of factors that affect any business owner's choice of payment types. But the continued importance of cash on the high street rings true through it all." Nick Quinn, Chief Corporate Affairs Officer at Link, said he was committed to keeping cash points available to all, adding, "We are making sure that people can access their cash and businesses can deposit their cash in every corner of the UK. That is critical as more and more people choose to pay with their contactless card. This research shows that we must continue to give businesses the option to bank their cash locally and keep a close eye on acceptance. But it also shows that businesses are committed to allowing people the choice of how to pay." Weatherman brings sunshine to audience with theatre tour. Former EastEnders actor Des takes Black Country stage in musical performance. An article by James Vukmirovich. He's been on our TVs and the stage for more than 30 years and has led a colourful life full of extraordinary moments. From leading roles on the West End, to being on the nation's TV screens in one of the most popular soaps, to his current life as a weatherman, Des Coleman has packed a lot into his life and work. The 60-year-old can be seen on ITV Central News as the weather presenter, but also tours the country performing in musicals and acting in plays, as well as a memorable turn in a Rat Pack group playing Sammy Davis Jr. Over the years, Des has said, He has had plenty of highs and lows, from Oscar parties with Bruce Willis to surviving several bouts of cancer, from time spent in the maximum security prison to hours on life support. Now he is set to take to the stage of Briley Hill Civic on April the 16th for a special night. Des Coleman, Sing Swing and the Musicals will see him, accompanied by a 10-piece big band, performing his favourite songs from his West End career, as well as a talk about his life and story in a show he said had been inspired by wanting to do something for his mum. He said, "It was really down to my mum, as she's getting on a bit and she's seen me do a lot of stuff. And I've been writing and trying to put together some stuff, but she's never seen me write, create and put something together and then appear on the show. At the show, I'll be cracking a few jokes and the band will play up and I'll be telling a few stories and saying how I was hearing songs when I was in the womb, but there will be a picture that I'll put up which pays homage to my mum. It's about saying how I wouldn't be here without this woman. And up on the screen will appear a picture of my mum in the 1960s, holding me when I was a year old, which will be an ah moment. And I wanted my mum to see it, so that's the main reason I'm doing this show." Des said the night would feature him telling stories about his career, including a few that nobody would have heard before, plus a wide range of songs, from Frank Sinatra to swing songs and musical theatre, as well as another singer who he said sounded just like Doris Day. He said it was nice to be able to take a look back at a career which saw him begin work on the West End stage in the early 1990s and then take on the role of Lenny Wallace in EastEnders, a role he played for 3 years. Following his stint on Albert Square, his career has seen a litany of West End and musical roles, as well as more acting roles, before a chance for a career change came in the mid-2000s, when he said that he was looking for a role that meant he could stay closer to home. He said, "I love entertaining and it's been one of those things that has always been massive in my life. And through acting for 10 years, EastEnders and the West End, I would be away from home for a long time on tour. After a while, you look back and you realise you haven't been spending that much time at home as you should. And it was one of those decisions where I wanted to try and find something that keeps me closer to home. I was living in Derby at the time and doing a radio show about musical theatre. And while I was there, someone asked me if I'd ever thought about doing the weather, as there was a slot coming up. And I believe that under this umbrella of entertainment, you've got to take opportunities when they come up. I'll never forget when I did my first practice, when they took me to the weather screen and I was moving around and they told me that I was coming out of my light, as weather presenters usually stand in one place. But I asked them how many lights they had and suggested they turn on a few more, so that allowed me to move around a lot more. That's the way I approach it, telling a story and moving around as people want a bit of light and shade and having a bit of fun, as the weather can be a bit dreary. It's a great gig at ITV, as it's a great team and they are really supportive." Des said that he got just as many people recognising him on the street for presenting the weather as for EastEnders and The One Show, and said it was still nice to be able to meet people and hear their stories. For the stage show, he said he was looking to put together a wide range of songs with a few challenging numbers along the way. He said, "I do a lot of show-stopping numbers, and one of those things with musical theatre is that you're born with a tenor voice, a baritone or something that's basic. And I'm lucky that I've got a good top note on me and I can hit a nice solid high note, which has kept me employed on the best end. In terms of tough songs, The Impossible Dream is a good one, as it's a song which really builds. Plus I'm learning to talk to the animals as well. And then I'm looking at Barry Manilow number, so it's a real mixed bag." Des said he has been lucky to have the experiences he's had and said that while the show was very autobiographical, it also didn't mean he'd done just yet. He said, "I don't know if that's my motto to my life, but I know that I'm lucky as I wake up and I just want to have a great time. And when I'm speaking to people, I just want them to smile. I enjoy that buzz and I get a good feeling about it. And I tend to surround myself with people who tend to laugh and don't take things too seriously. And that's what I'm all about." Des Coleman's Sing, Swing and the Musicals takes place at Broyley Hill Civic on April the 16th. For tickets and more information, go to the Civic website.
Hi, this is Kate and I'll be reading you some articles from the Express and Star, dated the 10th of March. £1.3 million to demolish centre to make way for homes. Council bids for cash to knock down former community centre. A council set to bid for £1.3 million to demolish a community centre to make way for new housing. Samwell Council will be bidding for the maximum amount from the government's Brownfield Land Release Fund to demolish the former Cradley Heath Community Centre in Redall Hill Road, Cradley Heath, to make way for around 13 new homes. The funding announced in 2024 and administered by the West Midlands Combined Authority, WMCA, could be used to clear neglected land such as empty buildings, former car parks and industrial sites to make way for new homes. The community centre was used by the Citizens Advice Bureau and Drugs and Alcohol Support Groups, as well as the Yemeni Community Association for English classes. The centre also hosted exercise, dance and art classes, a youth club, boxing, martial arts and karate groups, a children's soft play and yoga and tai chi classes. But despite being well used, the community centre was still ordered to close under a decision by the Labour-run authority last March. The council said the building was surplus to requirements and its running costs had become a significant expenditure, with councillors deciding it should be demolished to make way for a new housing in the future. The community centre was closed August last year. Labour-run Samwell Council set a saving target of £2.5 million in its property management budget, the buildings it owns and runs, last year. Samwell Council's Cabinet meets on the 11th of March to discuss and vote on the funding bid. The community centre, a former primary school that was converted in the early 1980s, was run by Samwell Community Hubs until 2022, when it was handed back to the council. The centre costs around £54,000 a year to run, according to Samwell Council, with repairs amounting to at least £11,000 a year. The council added it would need to spend at least £350,000 within the next 5 years to repair the building and at least a further £150,000 in the next 2 decades. The building's budget would be exhausted within the next 6 months. Councillors were warned over a year ago. The council said it would be helping community organisations and groups to relocate to new venues. Haydon Hill Leisure Centre was suggested as a potential location, but that facility is currently being replaced and is not expected to reopen until at least May 2027. And this article is supported by a picture of Cradley Heath Community Centre. Inquiries continue into e-bike crash. Inquiries into an e-bike crash that left 2 teenagers with serious injuries are continuing, police have confirmed. 2 teenagers were left with potentially life-changing injuries following a crash near a school in West Bromwich on Tuesday, the 3rd of March, which is believed to have been caused deliberately. West Midlands Police launched an investigation shortly after the youngsters were knocked off an electric bike in Clark's Lane, West Bromwich. Emergency services were called to the lane near Phoenix Collegiate at around 4:30 p.m. 2 teenagers, both male, aged 18 and 16, were confirmed to be the rider and passenger of the bike, and were left with injuries that were described as potentially life-changing. A spokesperson for West Midlands Police confirmed on Monday, March the 9th, that inquiries into the crash remain ongoing. Food Waste Action Week, UK Impact and Action, is the 9th to the 15th of March. The UK waste totals 4.4 million tonnes of edible food wasted per year. UK households throw away this amount. It's worth £17.5 billion, which is staggering annual value. The environmental cost? It means 16 million tonnes of greenhouse gases emissions are created annually, which intensifies climate pressures. Household impact? An average of £1,000 wasted per household of four every single year. The cost of living squeeze on family budgets, and 60% of all food waste happens in our homes. Commonly wasted foods and actionable tips: free slices of bread before they go stale, plan meals, blanch and freeze fresh vegetables, freeze excess milk in smaller portions, and love leftovers and turn them into new meals. Ring and ride services see decline in usage following reliability issues. Driver shortages and road congestions have resulted in a drop in the use of ring and ride across the West Midlands. Latest figures show between October and December 2025, there were 54,500 journeys made to the West Midlands bus on-demand service, a drop of 2.6% from the same period in the year before, when there were 55,970 trips. A report to the West Midlands Combined Authorities Transport Delivery Overview and Scrutiny Committee said new operators have been appointed to improve the service. Last year, Ring and Ride and Coventry's on-demand services have been brought together under a new operation known as West Midlands Bus On Demand in a bid to make the network simpler and easier to use. West Midlands Bus On Demand also introduced a series of upgrades which bosses say are designed to boost efficiency and passenger experience. These included the introduction of a fleet of smaller, more agile vehicles, allowing wheelchair users to travel together. A new contract for the Black Country Ring and Ride service has been awarded to operator HATS, which must be an acronym, H-A-T-S. The report to committee said passenger numbers on the West Midlands bus on demand services have reduced slightly between these periods. There was minimal impact on passenger satisfaction as the survey is pre-booked only, albeit journey availability will have been lower than desirable. From the 1st of December 2025, two new operators were mobilised. There have been some initial teething issues, however, service availability is now at 100%. The new service has included the introduction of the new vehicles, new technology and changes to the service operation. Sweetmaker Teddy Gray's marks 200 years in business. When people talk about the taste of the Black Country and the conversation goes into the best sweets, there's one place that always seems to come up top of the talk. Dudley's Edward Gray's, known locally as Teddy Gray's, have been producing and selling a range of hard-boiled sweets, all made from top-secret recipe, which has been passed down from generation to generation since the company was founded by John Gray in 1826. It has seen five generations keep traditional method of sweet making alive with the herbal tablet, the original and speciality product, fragrant and with a distinctive flavour that many companies have attempted to copy but have failed to match. Using traditional machinery at the production area on North Street in Dudley, the staff worked to produce the herbal tablets as well as other traditional sweets such as pear drops, rock, rhubarb and custard, and many other well-remembered favourites, all of which have a distinctive taste. Just walking around the production area, the smell of sweets is unmistakable, with a warm menthol smell which clears the nose quickly, emanating all around. The storage area is one filled with a range of sweets and treats, containers full of rhubarb and custard, menthol tablets, pear drops, and the rarely made tea cakes and toffee with coconut. With orders set to go out to places such as Cradley, Rowley Regis, and even as far as Wrexham in North Wales. It's also the office of the general manager, Dave Healy, who's been working at Edward Gray's for nearly 40 years having married into the family through his wife Julie, and who said the place was something very special, and spoke about how the herbal tablets became the popular product they are today. He said, "I think they first developed the flavour for the herbal tablets after starting out with herbal candy, because it was something you could tip out onto a slab and cut it by hand into little squares. And then they developed into what we know today. There are copies out there, but people just know the taste and instantly complain when they get somebody else's. But we should always explain that they're not ours and are a different brand. And they go and look for the packets which have the wire fox terrier on there. We'll never say what the secret ingredient is, and it's not in the ingredients, which are sugar, glucose, syrup, malic acid and natural flavouring. And it all comes down to a blending, as if you blend it in the wrong way, it'll start to burn and you'll get a paraffin taste." Mr. Healy said the art around the sweet making was important to everybody at the company, such as using the oils to make the sweets rather than essences, and using traditional machinery, which is harder to replace if things broke. The brand is one synonymous with Dudley and the Black Country, with Teddy Gray's shops found in four locations, including Dudley and Bewdley, while the shop website set up during the COVID-19 pandemic has become a popular place for people living abroad to find their old favourites. Dave Healy said that the name carried a lot of weight in the community, and spoke about the orders from abroad, saying that some people went to great lengths to get their grey sweets. He said, "I'll drive the van and the people just wave when I'm out driving past, because it has all the livery on it and the kids love it, and it can be a bit embarrassing sometimes, but still great. We mainly go around the Midlands and deliver outside the Midlands by carrier, but driving around does help, as we get calls from people who say they've seen our van and want to know if they can order, which we say they can by going onto our website. We also get people who order from outside the UK, like some who wanted to get a large jar of herbal tablets delivered to Australia, which is about £80 for postage. But people do pay, as they need to fill their craving." Mr. Healy said Edward Grey's was seen as something that had been in everyone's lives, and the fact it hadn't changed was what made it part of the Black Country. He said, "It's like we've never known another queen. Well, at least I haven't in my lifetime. And there are many other ways people who knew the king before. And that's how it goes with us, as people have just grown up with it. And every time they go in the shop, it hasn't changed. I just love this place. And every day it's a different day and a different challenges, as I do the sales, I do the fixing and I do the delivering. And it's all about getting out there, as we really don't advertise." So this is also supported by a couple of photographs, and you've got one with some equipment, some of the traditional sweet making equipment, and Dave is standing there in the factory, the production area. And then there's also a photograph of the classic packet, the white with the red writing, and also the picture of the dog on the front. Best sweets around, Teddy Gray's. I've been eating them all my life.
I'll be in match report. George Campbell's late goal earned West Brom a point at Sheffield United. Campbell redeemed himself with less than 10 minutes left on the clock after his own goal had given the Blades the lead earlier in the second half. The defender found the back of the net with a brilliant low strike to earn caretaker boss James Morrison his first point since taking charge, though Albion's winless run extends to 12 league games. The result saw West Brom move out of the bottom three at the expense of Leicester City, who drew at Ipswich, while United remain mid-table, 8 points from the playoffs. The first half passed largely without incident, with Blades defender Kijana Hoover responsible for the most memorable moment, when he sent the ball out for a corner from the opposition's half after misjudging a back pass. Albion skipper Jason Malumbi should have done better when the subsequent delivery fell to him unmarked, but he blazed over from close range. The game kicked into life within seconds of the restart, as Isaac Price was denied by an excellent save from Adam Davis after Darrell DK's through ball put him 1-on-1 with the home keeper. Typical of the visitors' recent luck, it was the hosts who then broke the deadlock. Campbell made a sliding intervention to stop Gustavo Hamer's cross in the 53rd minute, only to poke the ball past his own keeper and into the bottom corner. Davies was again on hand to deny Price when the winger tried a speculative effort from the edge of the box as Albion went in search of a leveller. At the other end, Callum O'Hare, Sidi Peck and Tyrese Campbell and Hamer were all guilty of missing good chances from close range as the Blades wasted numerous opportunities to double their lead. They were punished on 83 minutes when some lacklustre defending allowed Campbell a free shot at goal. He grasped the opportunity with both hands, producing a fine finish to send the away end into raptures and rescue a share of the spoils. James Morrison said, "We were a bit passive first half. I wasn't really happy with that. We addressed it at half time, and then we got a reaction. I didn't feel that they were on top or causing us a bit of trouble around the goal mouth. I don't think Max O'Leary really had much to do until they scored and we opened up trying to get back into the game. I have been talking about staying in the game, giving ourselves chances. We were away from home. We had to be solid. We had to make it a little bit ugly. We had to slow it down at times and wait for that moment when they come. We were a bit desperate in the final third. We were trying to score every time. But it's not the case. We can take that extra pass. On the other hand, George intercepts it and buries it. So I don't know."
Thanks to all our Sandwell volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us this week: James, Debbie, Lauren, Sarvjit, Jenny and Kate. And thanks to Rosie for doing the quiz for us this week too. Well, have a lovely week, everyone.
Thanks, Pam, and to everyone else, including Tony and Gavin, getting the USB sticks out. Do get them back to us on time, please. Just to tell you that next week's edition will be the last before Easter, after which we take a fortnight's break, but I'll be saying a bit more about that next week. In the meantime, coming up this week's edition of In Touch, but it's bye-bye from me, Ray, and all the Talking News team for this week. See you next week.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.